Hello, this is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315. Today's interview is with biochemist Fuzz Rana. He's the Executive Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe, a science-faith think tank based in Southern California. In the past, I've spoken to Fuzz about creating life in the lab. But as a son of a Muslim father and as the Vice President of Research of a leading Christian apologetics ministry, Dr. Rana has some strong opinions on how Christians should be responding to Islamic terrorism and the sorts of events we see more and more in the world today. So the purpose of today's interview is to discuss the Christian response to Islamic violence in the world. Well, thanks for joining me again for the podcast, Fuzz.
Brian, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been a couple of years since our last interview, and we spoke earlier about creating life in the lab. But, you know, you've been busy at Reasons to Believe. Would you mind talking a bit about the research you've been doing as of late and how the ministry's been growing?
Yeah, well, first, let's talk a little bit about the ministry. It's been some exciting times lately. We've actually moved into a new facility here in Southern California, and that's exciting because we actually have more space, and as a result of that, have been able to build a TV studio where we can actually produce broadcast quality video. And so this is going to enable us to extend our message into new marketplaces. This is the YouTube day and age, and we're going to be able to do a lot more with YouTube programming, again, reaching a generation that really watches more videos probably than they read. We've got classroom space in the facility. We've got a conference center. We can actually host public events here at the ministry. And we've got the space to expand a visiting scholar program where we're able to bring in scholars from all different disciplines, not only in science, but in theology and philosophy, to work with us and to just expand our depth and breadth of expertise. So really exciting times for the ministry. We really are growing, and we're deeply grateful for all the people that support the ministry, and we're grateful above all to God for the blessings. And from a personal standpoint, I'm excited because this past fall we reprinted a book called Origins of Life that I co-authored with Hugh Ross. This was the first book in apologetics that I wrote, and this is a book dealing with the origin of life question, focusing primarily on why a chemical evolutionary explanation for the origin of life simply doesn't work. And we've been able to bundle this as a trilogy with two other books, called The Cell's Design, which also deals with the origin of life question, but more focuses on the design of biochemical systems and how we can use that design to make a revitalized watchmaker argument. And then the third book would be Creating Life in the Lab that we discussed again a couple of years ago, which is about the work in synthetic biology, the attempting to create life in the lab, and what does that then mean, again, for the case for design. So those three books have been bundled together, and that's, again, exciting for me on a personal level. And in terms of, you know, upstream work, I've got a couple of ideas that are in play. One of them that I'm really excited about is this possibility that there very well may be a biochemical anthropic principle, meaning that the way in which biochemical systems look actually may be specified fundamentally by the laws of nature themselves, and that biochemical systems can't be any other way than the way that they are, again, being prescribed by the laws of nature. But the beauty is that those features that biochemical systems have that, again, seem to emanate from the laws of nature are exactly what you need to make life possible. And so this is, again, kind of applying the anthropic principle that most people know so well from cosmology into the biological realm, with the idea that, again, this is a powerful argument for design, but also suggests, again, a purpose to the universe, namely that life exists.
Well, there's a lot going on there. I'm really excited about your new facility and the things, how things are growing, and looking forward to seeing, you know, even more great content. And you mentioned there, you know, the origin of life. I'm so pleased about that sort of a resource because, you know, often you hear a lot of discussions about evolution, and it's round and round, but, you know, it's for me, I just like to push it back to the origin of life, because if you don't have something to begin with, it can't even evolve. So, and it can really refocus the question on the source, you know?
Yes, exactly right. I think the origin of life is a very powerful area in apologetics to really make a case for the creator. And as you say, if the life's origin requires the work of a mind, then it gives you the permission to look at all of life's history from that standpoint.
Well, great. Fuzz, in this interview, we're talking about something not science-related or biology, but nevertheless really relevant to current events, and that's this, the continuing rise of terror attacks and violence in the name of Islam. So you're the vice president of research in this apologetics ministry. Reason to believe they're always keen on responding to various challenges that Christians are facing in culture. So can you talk a bit about your own background and how that's relevant, you know, to this topic? You've been raised by a father who was a Muslim.
That's right. And, you know, if there are two things that define me, I guess, in many respects, it would be the fact that, A, I'm a scientist, a biochemist by training. And as you mentioned, you know, our organization is really about scientific apologetics, making a case for the Christian faith using science. But as you also point out, I was raised by a father who is a Muslim. And so that, again, is very much part of my identity. And I don't really spend a lot of time focusing on Muslim apologetics and really, you know, outreach and evangelism to Muslims, but I'm very sensitive to that issue, because I actually saw my father die as a Muslim, which was, again, really heartbreaking for me to know that he died not knowing who Jesus Christ was. And again, that was something that motivated me actually to go into full-time ministry, realizing that my father, who was a Muslim, who died as a Muslim, you know, really had nobody that connected with him and was able to present the gospel in a way that he could understand it and respond to it, including, unfortunately, his son. And so that, again, motivated me to recognize that my faith is really a pretty serious thing, and I've got a responsibility to reach out to people. But, you know, I did have an unusual upbringing to some respect. In some respect, my father was born in India. He was there prior to the time that India won its independence from Great Britain. And when that happened, of course, the partition took place, where the state of Pakistan was created. My father's family was forced to immigrate into Pakistan. He came from there to Canada, where he earned a PhD in nuclear physics, came to the United States, and was a college professor. He met my mom, who was a non-practicing Catholic at the time. So I grew up in a home where I had a mother who was from a Catholic background and a father who was a Muslim. And I used to think that that was a pretty unusual, you know, home environment. But recently I've met two other people who have identical stories, where their father was a Muslim and their mom was from a Catholic background. So maybe it's not all that unusual. But, you know, nevertheless, my father was a very religious man. He was a scientist, but he was deeply committed to Islam. But because my mom, again, was from a Catholic background, they decided that when it came to rearing their children, my brother and I, that they would not really force any religious perspective on us, that they would leave it up to us to decide. But again, my greatest exposure to any religious system growing up was Islam. When I was about 16 years old, I actually spent a year or so exploring Islam, in part because I think I desired to connect a little bit more deeply with my father and with my heritage. After about a year, I kind of gave up on that and really settled into a position of agnosticism. And it was in graduate school through science that I came to appreciate a creator must exist, and was then open to the gospel presentation. And so I converted to Christianity. And when I came back home and told my father what I had done, he was absolutely furious with me and was deeply hurt. It damaged our relationship. He, in a sense, disavowed me, and we were estranged until the time that he died. And so, again, I am not necessarily an expert on Islam, but I understand a Muslim worldview, if that makes any sense. I understand the ethos of being a Muslim, and that makes me very sensitive, I think, to how Christians respond to Muslims in light of many of these tragic and horrifying events that we see around the world that are perpetrated by Muslims.
Yeah, that's good. And you're mentioning a bit of your testimony there, and I just want to say to our listeners that Dr. Rana's testimony is available through the website. There's a link at today's blog post that you can click on, and it'll take you to a place where you can get a free download MP3 of Fuzz's testimony, and there's a lot of good stuff in there. But Fuzz, when you're looking at what's happening in the world today, how do you see things progressing with Islam? I mean, we'll talk a bit about our approach to that, but how have things been changing, and what is your impression overall as you look at the state of Islam and its progression?
Yeah, well, you know, clearly the world's attention is on Islam, you know, for I think the wrong reasons, unfortunately. But here in the United States, I think evangelical Christians have a greater interest in Islam than ever before. And I think many people really have a greater desire to reach the Muslim world with the gospel than ever before. But I think, unfortunately, many Christians really don't understand Islam and are not really sensitive to, again, what is the best way to approach Muslims with the gospel and what are things that we should do and shouldn't do. You know, and unfortunately, I think many of the people who claim to be experts in Islam do have a good book understanding of Islam, but oftentimes don't really understand, again, the worldview issues that are so critical in terms of how we would approach Muslims. So, you know, again, Islam is on everybody's mind and has everybody's attention. And hopefully, as evangelicals, we capitalize on that in a positive way, you know, again, to make the case for Christ.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different facets here to sort of look into and things to unpack. A couple of things come to mind, and we'll progress from there. But first is Islam's acceptance in culture. How do you see that? And also, you know, obviously there's a lot of increase in shocking violence that we're seeing. Do you think that these two are related? And if so, how?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, let me tell you a quick story, I think, that may set the stage for how I'm going to respond to that question. And I would actually be very interested in your perspective too, Brian, on this. Because, again, this is a very important question, and I think it's a very complex issue. But I grew up in the state of West Virginia here in the United States, and it's kind of a rural state. It's part of the Bible Belt. And as I was growing up there, again, my father was a Muslim, but we knew many other Muslims in the community. And here in the United States, West Virginia isn't a place where you would necessarily think there would be a lot of Muslims, but there were. They were part of the community. They were accepted as part of the community. Many of Muslims were, professionals. They were college or university professors. They were physicians, entrepreneurs. You know, they were, part of, again, the community, but they had a low profile. People didn't really realize, again, who they were, or didn't appreciate, again, who they were, but just understood them to be people who came from different parts of the world, who maybe had different religious perspectives, who weren't Christians, but again, that's where they left it. And I remember while I was in high school when the Iranian hostage crisis happened. This would have been in the 1970s. And the next day after, you know, everything kind of unfolded in a tragic way, I show up at high school the next day and was basically beaten up by a couple of people because they somehow equated me with, again, Iranians and with Muslims, just because, again, my father was from Pakistan. Of course, there was a deep need for a geography lesson there. But nevertheless, I think that, in a sense, is kind of, I think kind of echoes what we see in our culture today. There have always been Muslims with us, and they have been accepted as part of our communities. But we now have a different type of attention on Islam, and oftentimes there's a lot more fear and suspicion that we view Muslims with. They're not just simply exotic people from different parts of the world, but they're people that we have fear and suspicion of. And of course, Muslims, you know, are here in the United States. They have, you know, they're proud of their Islamic culture. They believe Islam is correct. They are enjoying the freedoms here in the United States. We live in a postmodern age where people with different religious perspectives are treated with in a way that all religions are true. All religions are different ways to go to reach out to God or to connect with God. You know, I think people, you know, also have somewhat of a pendulum swing towards maybe granting Muslims greater acceptance and greater a greater pass than they deserve in light of terrorist activities, because again, out of guilt or wanting to seem fair and reasonable people. And when you kind of put those things all together, I think you've got this really interesting sociological stew at play that probably sets up some kind of spiral where, again, you know, through Islamic pride, through the fear and suspicion that people have, through the freedoms that Muslims have, again, because of postmodern views about religious equality and, you know, and religious pluralism, you create an environment where Muslims, when they are persecuted or unfairly treated, actually it ends up inspiring terrorism to some degree, perhaps, or helping or causing Muslims maybe to have greater a greater sympathy for Islamic terrorists. So it's kind of a sociological stew, of course.
Yeah, definitely. And there's so many things at play, as you had mentioned. One of the things what we want to talk about today is the proper response from Christians to Muslims and it is Islam in general. And we mentioned there how Islam is being more accepted in culture, maybe because of fear, and of course the pluralism you mentioned. Are there certain ways that just really get under your skin as far as how Christians react poorly when it comes to Islam or, you know, responding to things that we see in the media?
Yeah, and I think this is really a point where we can probably derive a larger principle that really applies to all apologetics. And that, you know, is, again, going back to the passage in 1 Peter 3:15 and 16, you know, always be prepared to give a reason for the hope that you have to anyone who asks, and do so with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience. And it seems to me that in the context of that passage, what Peter is basically arguing is that apologetics, or the reasons that we give, are really ultimately tied to evangelism, or to serving, or apologetics should serve discipleship. And so really, apologetics should never be done for the sake of doing apologetics. And oftentimes, unfortunately, I see a lot of people who are interested in apologetics who see apologetics as the end goal. And that oftentimes leads, I think, to a lot of pride and arrogance, though I don't think that's the intention whatsoever. And oftentimes when you begin to think about apologetics for the sake of apologetics, you wind up doing things that ultimately undermine apologetics. And, you know, we always need to think about, again, as we use apologetics, who are we presenting the arguments to, and are we viewing those people as a mission field? You know, it reasons to believe one of the things that we see that's so tragic is that oftentimes the church views scientists and people influenced by science as enemies of the faith. They see science and scientists as such a threat to the faith that they view them as enemies. And so the apologetics that are undertaken oftentimes are more not giving reasons, but attacking that other perspective and consequently attacking that person. And I see a lot of parallels, unfortunately, with how, again, Christians engage Muslims in terms of apologetics. We don't look at Muslims as a mission field, but we look at them as people who we have fear and suspicion about. And that then begins to shape our apologetics. And so a lot of things that are done in terms of Muslim apologetics really aren't bridge building at all, aren't treating Muslims as a mission field, but rather, again, looking at how can we put Muslims in their place? How can we show that Islam is false? And so a lot of times, the very first thing that you see out of people's mouths are an attack on the Quran, an attack on Muhammad, an attempt to expose Islam as a religion of hate and violence as opposed to a religion of peace. And I think there are places where those kinds of conversations are very important and those arguments are very important, but oftentimes people lead in that way. And, you know, it's interesting. 1 Peter 3:15 says, give a reason for the hope that you have. It doesn't say that we should give a reason for why the other person's perspective is wrong, but rather we should give a reason for the hope that we have. And so we really, I think, need to focus when we engage Muslims on what is true about Christianity. Why is Christianity the proper way to understand who God is and our relationship to that Creator? Why is Christianity the way in which we can achieve salvation, as opposed to focusing on what's wrong with Islam and, again, having these attacks masquerade as apologetics?
So, Fuzz, I'm just thinking that through and I'm thinking about my own perspectives and things and or mindsets that we could carry. Maybe one mindset might be Muslims are the enemy. Islam is the enemy. We need to, you know, defeat that one way or another. But what I hear you saying is that, you know, no, these are people. These are people who we want to win to Christ, and that our case shouldn't be to tear them down as a person or tear their religion down, but to share Christ, to share the truth of the Christianity. Would that be accurate, or how would you phrase that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think, again, it's important to recognize that there are Islamic groups around the world who are the enemy in the sense that they are perpetrating violence, that they are creating and are causing atrocities, that they are, and again, motivated by their Islamic beliefs to do these things. And I do believe, you know, in black and white terms, they really are the enemy. But the way that we deal with those people, I think, are through political means, and if we have to, through military means. But we shouldn't, again, engage Muslims in that same mindset. But rather, we want to look at how are we going to win these people to Christ, because ultimately, I believe that the solution is not going to be political or military. It's going to ultimately be the gospel penetrating the Muslim world and the transforming power of the gospel. So the most effective thing we could do ultimately to combat the violence of Islam that's very real is by having an effective presentation of the gospel, having the gospel penetrate the Islamic world. But we're never going to do that by attacking a Muslim. And, you know, something that we have to appreciate is that as Christians who, particularly Christians who live in the Western world, our religious identity as Christians is important to us, but it's not all the time central to who we are. I heard it described by my friend Abdu Murray, who is a former Muslim who came to faith in Christ, who has a ministry called Embrace the Truth International, as in the West, if you think of our lives as being a circle, our religious beliefs are a small dot in the middle of that circle. Whereas for a Muslim, their religious beliefs are so deeply intertwined with their identity that it's very difficult to separate one from the other. And this is why, for example, when I became a Christian, my father reacted so violently to my conversion, why he was so upset with me. It's because in his mind, I rejected everything about who I was. I rejected my family. I rejected my heritage. It was a huge insult to my father, in a sense, when I became a Christian for that reason. And so when you attack Muhammad, you attack the Quran, as you know, you challenge Islam in certain ways, that are offensive to a Muslim, it's not just simply it's analogous to somebody insulting Christianity. It's a very deep insult that's difficult to describe, again, because it's a worldview type it's a worldview mindset. There's a difference in worldviews here at play. And so the offense is much deeper than we would anticipate it to be from a Western Christian mindset.
Yeah, there's some good insights there, Fuzz. I want to ask you to talk a bit about how we can wrongly make just sweeping generalizations when it comes to Islam. What's the danger in that?
Well, you know, again, we want to be careful not to adopt the mindset that, you know, because most acts of terror around the world are caused by Muslims, that all Muslims are terrorists. Because again, that really sets up a mindset that, again, Muslims are people that we somehow need to vanquish, as opposed to people that we need to reach with the gospel. And I think even if we do want to reach Muslims with the gospel, again, that mindset, I think, compromises our effectiveness at sharing the gospel with Muslims. And so, you know, sweeping generalizations are very dangerous. On the other hand, I don't think we want to be naive. You know, I think we do want to recognize that there is an element of Islam that is really very violent, that does have evil intentions at its very core, that hates the West, and it looks to again, you know, commit these atrocities as and sees those atrocities that they commit as in a sense honoring Islam and advancing their faith and defending their faith. So we don't want to be naive about that. We want to be really shrewd in terms of how we engage the Islamic world, but let's be balanced and let's be thoughtful about what we're doing.
Yeah, very good. Now, we're not talking deeply about what Muslims believe or the core tenets of Islam or anything like that. There are a lot of great resources for that. We're talking more about how we approach, you know, our apologetics with Muslims, how Christians would respond rightly in a way that's winsome and that sort of thing. So, but that being said, are there some key things that Christians should know about Islam in general that would help them in how they approach these various issues? You mentioned there about their identity being tied to Islam very deeply, and I'm wondering what other things that might be that Christians might be unaware of that would help them.
Well, you know, I think in my mind the best strategy is to first look for places of common ground. And, you know, for example, Muslims are people that are very moral people. Islam is a religion of high morality, just as Christianity is. And as Christians, we believe there's objective morality that comes from God. Well, Muslims believe the same thing as well. And so from that standpoint, we have common ground with them, particularly in a world where people view morality in relativistic terms. And so that is a place where we can begin to build bridges and establish a rapport with Muslim people. Muslims, like Christians, believe in a transcendent personal God. They believe that God is great, as we do as Christians, and that greatness demands a worship, and that God is, again, to be honored because he is the greatest of all beings. In fact, one of the most common arguments that Christian apologists like to use for God's existence, the Kalam cosmological argument, is an argument actually developed by Muslim scholars. And so, again, that's something that we would have in common. You know, Muslims have a very high view of Jesus. They wouldn't, of course, deny his divinity. They would deny that he's the Son of God, but still they have a very high view of Jesus. And so that's a place where we can, again, establish some common ground and a place where we can begin to have great conversations. Muslims, are, again, many are creationists and are sympathetic to design, or intelligent design specifically. And so again, this is a place where, through scientific evidence for God's existence and scientific challenges to a naturalistic paradigm, an evolutionary paradigm, are places that we could find, again, common ground. And it's once we find those places of common ground, now we can begin to have great conversations about our differences, but it's a very different kind of conversation than when we focus first on our differences and exclude the fact that there really is common ground. You know, it's interesting. My friend Abdu Murray, is who I just mentioned, was telling me that it wasn't really the fact that he became convinced that Islam was false that led him to convert to Christianity. It's that he came to realize that Christianity was true. And that he said, I never really suddenly began to believe in God now that I became a Christian. I always believed in God. It's just that I had a right view of God. And so that's what I think we want to focus on, is helping Muslims see how we as Christians understand God and begin to argue and defend the fact that our view is the right view of God, and help to transition them from what we would argue is an incorrect view of God to a correct view of God. But there's a lot of places of common ground and agreement that we can find in the process of doing that.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff there. I'm thinking about a few things. First, it would be the witness that Christians have to their Muslim neighbors or friends. And in that regard, I'm thinking about how we want to approach them, how we want to seek to share the truth with them, and that sort of thing. But at the same time, I think there's another facet about what Christians say about Islam when there's no Muslims around, and how that maybe is portrayed to other unbelievers who, you know, they're not Muslims, but they're hearing what Christians are saying about Islam, their views, their comments, whatever they might be saying. What are your thoughts on that, and how Christians should speak well of others and maybe not tear down Islam and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. And again, I think it's not something that I've necessarily thought deeply about, but I think you're bringing up a very good point, Brian, and that is this idea that the way in which we engage Muslims in public should be the way that we view them in private, that there should be this integrity in how we think about Muslims. And, unfortunately, I am of the opinion, having been involved in apologetics for a lot of years now, and I could be looking at the mirror when I say this, but that there's sometimes some of the people who are the best apologists actually do the most damage, again, to the Christian faith and to evangelism, because they don't truly love the people that they're trying to reach out to. And I always have to remind myself that when I engage a non-Christian, that if I cannot first and foremost say that I truly love that person, I probably shouldn't engage in an apologetic enterprise with that individual, because it's not going to turn out very well. And the idea that I can, you know, as I look at myself in the mirror of my bedroom, say that I truly love that person in private, it's going to now translate into how I talk about that person, whether it's in a public format or behind closed doors, and no matter who's listening, my message is going to be consistent. And so you bring up a really good point there. And, you know, it's something that we all struggle with when we engage in apologetics. But again, we want to be people of integrity as we, again, think about the types of arguments that we make, whether it's, again, engaging Muslims or engaging anybody else who has a different philosophical or religious system than we have as Christians.
Now, Fuzz, would you spell out maybe one or two key things to do and what not to do when addressing Islam that maybe you haven't touched on?
Yeah. Well, again, you know, I think it's important to realize that we do want to talk about the differences that we have between, again, our concept of God, differences that we have in terms of our view of Jesus. But we have to be careful, too, to realize that, again, for a Muslim, they view God as being wholly transcendent. And when you begin to say that God is a Trinity, there you say that Jesus is God, that to a Muslim is a blasphemous statement. Now, of course, we want to make sure that we are talking about those differences, but I think we want to be sensitive to the fact that, again, for a Muslim, that is blasphemous. So Again, we don't want to shy away from that conversation by any means. Otherwise, we're never going to be able to present the gospel. But we also want to be, again, cognizant of how Muslims view those statements and those ideas. I think we also, again, want to be cautious about insulting Muhammad or denigrating the Quran. Again, there will be points when in the conversation, in the engagement, where we will have to talk about Muhammad's character. We will have to talk about problems in the Quran and why we don't think the Quran is correct. But again, we want to be sensitive as we step into those conversations, not to lead with those points. Now, from a positive standpoint, I think one thing that we want to emphasize is that as Christians, we are able to know God, that we are able to engage in a deep and profound relationship with the Creator of the universe through the Trinity, through the person of Christ, through His death on the cross, and through the power of the Holy Spirit. And this is something that is foreign to a Muslim because for a Muslim, God is wholly transcendent. He is unknowable. All a Muslim can know is the will of God, but they cannot know Allah as a person, whereas we can as Christians. And I think this is a very powerful point from a theological standpoint, and that is that there's something special that we have as Christians that, you know, for a Muslim to say that God would condescend himself to make himself known to mere human beings, they see that again as blasphemous, as again denigrating the nature and the greatness of God. But if we can actually show that this is actually what makes God great, that we now are going to get a Muslim's attention. And to recognize that prayer for us as Christians is a component of the relationship that we have with that Creator, whereas for a Muslim, prayer is an obligation. And so these are very important things, I think, to highlight in our conversation, that God is knowable and how wonderful a thing it is to be able to experience God, and then also to be able to communicate the certainty that we have in with regard to our salvation. For a Muslim, you know, salvation is works-based, and Muslims are never certain about their salvation. And in fact, I watched my father die a rather tormented death. He told me to my face, and this was something that my mother also emphasized with me in private, is that my father viewed my conversion to Christianity as the greatest failure in his life. And that he felt that he had let his father down and that God was going to be angry with him as a result of my conversion to Christianity. And he suffered horrible health issues towards the end of his life, and he felt that that was essentially punishment that Allah was giving him for, again, my conversion to Christianity. And my mom would tell me that he would have dreams at night about his father coming to him, being angry with him because I converted to Christianity. And the point I'm making here is this, is that my father died a tormented death where he had no certainty of salvation, though he lived his entire life very much committed to Islam. And I think that's something that makes Islam in many respects unlivable, if that makes any sense. And again, this is the type of thing that we want to emphasize in our conversation with Muslims, is the fact that we have this certainty with regard to our salvation because of what Jesus did for us on the cross, and how this is a manifestation of unbelievable love, the greatest possible love that is commensurate with the greatest possible God.
One thing it seems that there is a real push for in society is to accept Islam. Don't offend Muslims. To acknowledge Islam as a religion of peace. How would you advise Christians to respond in a way that accepts Muslims, which doesn't equate to accepting Islam?
Yeah, you know, this is really a very tricky issue. And, you know, and it's something that I honestly struggle with because, again, when you look at the Quran, when you look at Muhammad's example, It's very easy, at least at face value, to interpret the Quran, to interpret Muhammad's example in such a way to see Islam really as a religion that promotes violence, particularly to spread or to evangelize, again, the Islamic faith. Yet there are Muslim scholars who, again, offer, you know, more subtle and nuanced interpretations of those types of passages. And so I think it's important to realize that Muslims are not monolithic on this issue. And it's not clear if, you know, these, you know, subtle interpretations and these nuanced interpretations are for PR purposes or are they really authentic? I think in many instances they probably are authentic. My father, who was again a committed Muslim, was a pacifist, you know, believe it or not. And so, you know, again, this is a really difficult issue. But I think, you know, in my mind, it's best probably to leave the whole question of is Islam a religion of peace? Is it a religion that promotes violence? Maybe on the side table, and really just focus on each Muslim as an individual and find out exactly what they believe and engage them on those terms, recognizing again that Muslims are people that are made in God's image, that they are people that Jesus died on the cross for, and that the gospel is for them as well. And you know, I think if we have that viewpoint, I think we may be able to separate Islam as a religion again, and as a maybe even as a political movement in some instances from the people who are Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered a lot of different facets here. We've talked about how we relate to Muslims and our witness and different ways that we can approach them to share Christ with them. One thing I want to ask is, do you think that current events can open any doors for ministering to people or through conversations or things of that nature?
Oh, I think so, most definitely. You know, and again, if you recall the story I told about growing up in the 70s and the Iranian hostage crisis, you know, and again, the fact that I went to high school and, you know, people who I knew were Christians who, you know, kind of bullied me and things like that, you know, that was just really the absolute wrong response. And I think there's a lot of Muslims who are probably horrified at what's happening in the name of Islam. And they are concerned probably for their own safety. They're concerned that people may, you know, may persecute them. They may discriminate against them because of what's happening around the world. Again, where you have all these different acts of terror on the part of Islamic terrorists. And I think this is a great time for Christians to reach out to the people that they know who are Muslims and to befriend them and go one step beyond what you might normally do in terms of a casual friendship, but really reach out to them with a spirit of love. Because again, I think a lot of times Muslims are just cringing, expecting the worst from people, you know, in the West who are non-Muslims in again, as a response to these acts of terror. And if we actually respond with love, I think we could go a long way towards opening up doors that could lead to really important conversations.
Well, very good. Fuzz, we've covered a lot of ground and our time is running out. But before we go, I want to ask if you'd point our listeners to any further resources that you think will help them grow in their understanding of the things we've discussed today, or even if there's some new things that Reasons to Believe has produced that you'd want to point people to.
Yeah, well, there are two ministries I would point people to. One would be Embrace the Truth International. This is a ministry headed up by my friend Abdu Murray, a former Muslim who converted to Christianity. And then also Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. And there are two people that I know personally that I think are excellent apologists when it comes to engaging Muslims. This would be Andy Bannister, who's at RZIM Canada, and then Nabil Qureshi, who's at RZIM in the United States. Those are three excellent people that you would want to find out the types of resources they produce, because I think they do the best job, in my opinion, of reaching out to Muslims and equipping Christians to reach out to Muslims. And one of the things that we actually were able to do in December We had Abdu Murray here visiting our offices, and I sat down with him, and we recorded a series of 14 or 15 videos where I was interviewing Abdu Murray about Christianity and Islam, and these are being released on YouTube through our YouTube channel, which is Reasons to Believe One, Reasons to Believe the number one. And if people go there, they can get those videos. They're being posted in the next few weeks. We're going to post all of the videos eventually. But those are great videos that give people bite-sized introductions to some of the issues we've talked about today and some of the details about how Islam and Christianity differ and the most effective way to reach, again, Muslims with the gospel.
Well, very good. Fuzz, really grateful for you being with me today and for the chance to speak with you again. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure to be with you. I hope this has been helpful to your listeners.
I've been speaking with Fuzz Rana, Executive Vice President of Research and Apologetics at Reasons to Believe. More resources by Dr. Rana, as well as Reasons to Believe, can be found at today's blog post at Apologetics 315. Be sure to visit there for a link to a free MP3 download of Fuzz Rana's testimony, available for a limited time. If you've enjoyed the interview, please share it with a friend on Facebook or Twitter. You can also leave a review on iTunes, which helps us to promote the podcast by encouraging others to listen. You can find us on Facebook at Apologetics315 and on Twitter at Apologetics315. There you'll find links to lots of great resources, as well as great deals on discounted apologetics books on Kindle. Please help us get the word out about good apologetics resources. I want to remind those who'd like to support Apologetics 315 that you can do so by using our Amazon affiliate links, located at the right-hand side of apologetics315.com. When you do your normal shopping from Amazon, using those links allows a small portion of your purchase to support what we're doing, and it only costs you a click. Those links can also be bookmarked for ease of use whenever you shop online. We continue to transcribe these interviews with the help of volunteer transcribers, and if you'd like to help with more, just email me at interviews@apologetics315.com. If you have suggestions for the interviews, you can email me there as well. This is Brian Auten, and thanks again for listening.